warning is in effect for American Samoa, Samoa, Niue, Wallis Futuna, Tokelau, Cook Islands, Tonga, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Kermadec Islands, Fiji, Howland Baker, Jarvis Islands, New Zealand, French Polynesia, Palmyra Islands, Vanuatu, Nauru, Marshall Islands and Solomon Islands. A tsunami watch is in effect for Johnston Island, New Caledonia, Cosrae, Papua New Guinea, Hawaii, Pohnpei, Wake Island, Pitcairn, Midway Island, Chuuk and Australia. And New Zealand is bracing itself for a 1 metre high tsunami after the earthquake. Civil defence authorities in New Zealand have urged people in low-lying areas there to get to higher ground. Nathan Becker from the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre in Hawaii says the centre is monitoring the situation. And Geraldine, there'll be more news coming up on the hour.
Christine, thank you. We'll look forward to it.
Hello, Simon Conway joining you with the sports news for Radio Australia. We begin with the Pacific Mini Games in the Cook Islands, where the tennis singles elimination matches are underway after the team event wrapped up last week. John Pupic was courtside for the singles matches.
Some fantastic games of singles tennis were on show today. The game that really got my eye was the game between Vanuatu's up-and-comer Andrew Miltorok and New Caledonia's number one player Nicholas Godella. Nicholas Godella won the game in two sets, 6-1, 6-2. Nicholas said after the game he has to play his best game and not underestimating his opponents.
I play very seriously, so I knew the player was a good player, so it was very difficult, but after I played very well, and then I can have a rest for tomorrow.
He was a class above the rest of the participants here because of his experience in Roland Garros back in August this year in the French Open. His opponents in the semi will be Malcolm Kenego of Tahiti, who won his game this morning against Liu Feke of Tonga. Today also sees the women's singles events, and later today we'll see the men's and women's doubles. Tennis events will end on Thursday. John Pupic, Rarotonga.
Rugby League Sevens also features in this year's games. Here's John Pupic again with all the details.
The four countries who sent their teams were Tonga, Samoa, host Cook Islands and Fiji. Each team will have to play each other three times to see which teams have the most points to go into the semi-finals tomorrow. The first game sees Samoan out victors by 6 points, 18 points to 12. The second game featured host Cook Islands and Fiji. Fiji won that match 24 points to 18. Despite its good effort in the first game, Fiji went down to Tonga in the third match 24-20. Its coach Semese Thadra Kilongi said his team put up a pretty good effort.
So far I'm happy with the boys, with their performance, and a little bit of mistakes during the play cost them a lot of defense and ending up Tonga scoring twice.
The fourth game was between Cook Island and Samoa, and the game ended in a draw.
Thank you very much for that, John. That ends our coverage for the moment from the Pacific Mini Games. But we will have all the latest news in our sports updates throughout the day and across Radio Australia. To the NRL Grand Final now, and the Melbourne Storm says the team isn't worried about playing in front of a hostile crowd in Sunday's Grand Final against Parramatta. Melbourne's playing in its fourth straight Grand Final, while the Eels are playing in the club's first decider since 2001. Storm forward Ryan Hoffman says the players know they'll be facing a pro Parramatta crowd on Sunday.
We've sort of come to expect it the past couple of years, being an outside team from an outside state coming into Sydney. We played against Manly the past couple of years and they're very well supported, and sort of going playing the game in the southwest of Sydney in Parramatta's heartland, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of Parramatta supporters, but our supporters are very good at travelling too, and they get really excited for Grand Final week just like we are.
Parramatta captain Nathan Kalis has played down criticism of the system used for the NRL finals. The Eels are attempting to become the first side to win the NRL premiership from eighth spot at the end of the regular season. Parramatta only won 5 out of their first 18 games, but have since won 10 out of 11 games. Kalis says the Eels' late charge into the grand final has been great for the game.
Hey, we've worked hard for it. We had to win 7 in a row just to get in the 8. We've won 3 games in a row now, and we've won them pretty convincingly. Our defence has been strong, so you know, we've worked hard for it. We earned it. We had to play the team who came first, and we're the best team all season, and that's fair enough. They they had the home game and we're here now.
Former Australian rugby player David Campese is switching allegiances. He's going to help the Tongan Sevens team should it qualify for next year's World Series. The man who was capped 101 times for the Wallabies will also conduct clinics in Tonga next month. The most promising junior footballers from around Australia have gathered in Canberra for the AFL's annual draft camp. 75 players have been invited to the camp. They'll be put through a series of tests in front of recruiting staff from the league's 16 clubs. But one of this year's top prospects, 18-year-old South Australian Jack Trengove, won't be there. The Sturt midfielder is staying in Adelaide to prepare for a local grand final this weekend, but his coach, Luke Norman, says it won't hurt his chances of getting drafted.
Jack, he's a superstar, isn't he? He's definitely a talent, and he's a 200-game player in AFL football, I reckon.
And for the moment, that's all the news in sport.
Thank you very much, Simon Conway. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, and it's 7:35 in Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. Good morning, I'm Geraldine Coutts. Anti-drug authorities will be watching closely to see how well a new device developed in New Zealand works in the fight against methamphetamine. New Zealand is battling a big problem with meth, or P, as it's more commonly known locally. It's hit epidemic proportions, with more and more people setting up P labs in rental properties. The new device gives landlords the ability to bust bad tenants. New Zealand correspondent Kerry Ritchie reports.
Methamphetamine is a growth industry in New Zealand, estimated to be worth more than $1 billion.
It's the home, possibly one of the world leaders in small home labs, and that's possibly due to the isolation of the country and the number 8 wire, give it a go type of mentality that we have, and so it is pervasive.
Jeff Dye's Auckland company has developed the Meth Minder. It looks just like a smoke alarm and is also fitted to the ceiling of a house. But this little tamper-proof box is a world first, according to Jeff Dye.
It's actually chock-a-block with a whole host of technology from gas analysers, gas loggers, communication devices. And it's a completely standalone, self-powered, and it monitors the environment 24/7, and we get regular updates on what's happening within the environment, within a property.
Jeff Dye says the device can detect straight away if someone is manufacturing methamphetamine.
If someone did cook up meth, it would pick up the very, very specific gases given off during the process, and that would alarm to us, and we have a direct link to the police.
2 years ago, Kerry O'Rourke's tenant set up a P-lab in his rental property in Hamilton, an hour south of Auckland.
All of a sudden, there was a police bust on the house. Basically, your hell broke loose after that for about 3 months.
The home had been contaminated by the toxic gases, and Kerry O'Rourke couldn't rent it out. He had to pay for all the repairs.
It cost me a bit of money, and the guy is now in jail for what he'd done, so you're up for a lot of money because insurance companies don't comply with P-labs in people's houses, so you stand to lose the house and no insurance, so it is a big worry.
Kerry O'Rourke says the meth minder sounds great because the gases can be hard to smell.
It's sort of a tangy smell. It's very faint. You wouldn't notice it otherwise, I don't think. If you had a some sort of gadget where it could pick it up, it would be the only way you can really notice it, unless it was really strong, but in this case it wasn't, and it was only because it was brought to my attention by the police that I was able to recognise it.
Kerry O'Rourke says in New Zealand, 48 hours notice has to be given before any house inspections, which allows tenants to move the lab to another property.
It's very hard to tell with your tenant. They can have the best record ever, but once you get into drugs, I mean, you can go downhill really fast, so you just don't know your tenants.
Jeff Dye says his device is starting to take off.
Been called by people in Australia, Canada. We get people coming from the States.
Have you had any successes yet where your alarm has raised the alarm?
No, thankfully, and one of the main reasons for that is that it's a very, very good deterrent. People would have to be pretty silly to give it a crack, and they'll just go next door or go somewhere else. I think it's the best outcome, is to deter them. I mean, it helps right at the selection process when you're interviewing people. You let them know that this property is protected or monitored, and they tend to default at that stage. It also prevents other people from being coerced. Relationships change, of course, with people that rent property, and there's quite a lot of coercion goes on for even owner-occupied properties in this country now, regrettably.
The Auckland businessman Jeff Dye ending that report by our New Zealand correspondent Kerry Ritchie. A former New Zealand member of the UN Security Council says it's a mistake to prevent Fiji from supplying the UN with peacekeepers. The UN will not consent to Australia and New Zealand's request for Fiji peacekeepers to be excluded until they find another country which can continue the supply of blue helmets to the UN. Terence O'Brien believes Australia and New Zealand's tough stance on Fiji is undermining Pacific regionalism. Mr. O'Brien is quick to point out that though he does not support the 2006 coup in Fiji, but says Australia and New Zealand's push to prevent Fiji from taking part in peacekeeping duties is taking the sanctions too far.
The first reason really relates, I guess, to Pacific Island policy of New Zealand. I can't speak for Australia, of course. I believe that New Zealand would be better advised to quieten, to moderate somewhat some of its policy positions vis-a-vis Fiji. I believe we've overreacted, and the result is that the whole basis for regionalism in the Pacific Island area has been undermined, that Fiji is no longer playing a part in that, and that really isn't in New Zealand, or dare I say, Australia's interests, particularly New Zealand, which had a big original hand in creating the basis for Pacific Island regionalism way back in the 1970s. And I think we sort of lost sight of the larger picture. And so the first reason why I was critical of it is I think we should learn to be more moderate. This is not in any way to try and exonerate Bainimarama for what he's done in Fiji, which is, of course, totally unacceptable. But the way in which you react diplomatically is important in cases like this.
Well, Commodore Bainimarama, in his address at the UN at the weekend, made similar points. He was saying what can be gained through Fiji not taking part in the peacekeeping operations and what's in it for New Zealand and Australia. What's your response to that?
Well, that's the second reason for my criticism. First of all, the United Nations is in desperate need of quality peacekeepers. And what we've seen over recent years is a definite decline in the quality of peacekeeping forces which are committed to the UN by its member states. And New Zealand and Australia have been partly responsible for that, because we no longer place soldiers, certainly New Zealand doesn't, and I don't think Australia, but here again, I'm talking mainly about New Zealand. New Zealand does not place its troops any longer under the blue helmet UN peacekeeping. It far prefers these so-called UN mandated operations, like the ones led by NATO in Afghanistan or by Australia in East Timor and so on, and that we have ceased in effect to support the UN peacekeeping. The United Nations Secretariat is under great pressure to try and find quality peacekeepers, and now what Australia and New Zealand are in fact saying to the UN is, we aren't actually going to support you with more peacekeepers ourselves, because we've got other interests and other priorities. And by the way, don't you think of enlisting support from countries with which we have political disagreements, i.e. Fiji. That seems to me to be pretty shonky diplomacy. And if they sat down and thought about it, both governments, they might see it that way. It's bad United Nations policy, and it's bad South Pacific policy.
Well, is the United Nations itself being ingenuine by seeking Fiji peacekeepers because they can't get enough elsewhere? Ethically, do they think that Fiji shouldn't be taking part, but they're more desperate for troops, so they'll proceed and keep employing them?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is by saying that the United Nations has taken peacekeepers from countries which have military dictatorships, and has not balked at that in the past, and neither has New Zealand or Australia advised them not to do it. And, of course, a chief example of this has been Pakistan, which is currently one of the largest supporters of UN peacekeeping. But there are other countries like Thailand that had a military coup. We never moved to suggest to them that they shouldn't take Thai soldiers, and so on. And you can quote a number of examples down through the years of a similar kind. So, again, this is a third reason, if you like. The third reason is inconsistency on the part of New Zealand and Australia on this matter with the UN. Are we telling the United Nations we don't agree with any military regime being asked to supply troops, and incidentally at the same time telling them that we're not going to supply them either? I mean, that seems to be, it's a completely unthought through policy and a piece of policy. And it's absolutely par for the course with the way in which New Zealand and Australia have been reacting to the Fiji situation in the recent past.
Terence O'Brien, Senior Fellow at the Centre for Strategic Studies in Wellington, New Zealand. He was also a former member of the UN Security Council. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Now back to our main story of the day, and the 8.3 magnitude earthquake has hit just off the coast of American Samoa, just 180 kilometres from Hi'ifo in Tonga and 200 kilometres from Samoa's capital Apia. The latest report from the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre is now in with some measurements of tsunami wave activity. Rarotonga in the Cook Islands, 0.47 metres, that's 1.5 feet. Apia in Opolu in western Samoa, 0.7 of a metre, 2.3 feet. Pongo Pongo, 1.57 metres, that's 5.1 feet. US National Park Service official says the quake and tsunami in American Samoa has caused deaths, but there's no word on how many. Niue, Wallace and Futuna, Tokelau and Cook Islands are also within short distance of the quake and tsunami, as is the top end of New Zealand. Reports are still coming in, but the massive quake was also very shallow at 21 miles under the surface, and the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre has issued a tsunami warning for all regional Pacific states. New Zealand is one of them, and we're joined now by Adrian Prowse of the Ministry of Civil Defence and Emergency Management. Mr. Prowse, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
We've given what we know as being the latest, but can you just tell us what your knowledge of the situation is?
Yeah, the most important thing that, from our perspective is to relay to the public that the wave height, the estimated wave height for arrival in New Zealand is no more than 1 metre, and that the messaging that we're communicating to the public for obvious reasons now is to not go down to the shoreline to have a look, stay away from the shoreline, stay away from river estuaries and river mouths and low-lying sea level areas. At this point, we're not communicating a requirement to evacuate, primarily just to stay away from those low-lying areas.
So when do you think the 1 metre wave will arrive in New Zealand? And we're talking about the North Island.
We're talking about the North Island at this stage. The estimate that we have for the East Cape region of New Zealand, which is north of Gisborne, is an arrival time around 9:44 local time, and Gisborne City itself around 10 a.m. local time.
So that's not too far off. The 9:44 is not too far away then?
It's not too far away. Now, we have been working very closely with the regional local authorities and to ensure that they are able to work effectively with their communities to ensure that the necessary warnings are communicated to the public in a prompt fashion, yeah.
So why are you not advising people now in the 9:44 when it's going to hit to go to higher ground?
Because we're not talking about a wave, a significant wave. We're talking about a relatively small wave, but nevertheless a potential threat to people if they're on the beach. So the responsibility for warning people in the Gisborne region is the Gisborne local authority, and we're working very closely with them to ensure that the public are getting the necessary information they require.
And where are you getting your information from?
We work very closely with our science agencies, Geological and Nuclear Sciences in New Zealand, to ensure that we have the most up-to-date scientific information and reliable information to actually communicate to the public what's the most important thing to do.
Okay, so what happens now as far as the Ministry of Civil Defence and Emergency Management is concerned in New Zealand?
Well, the key thing is because of the geography of New Zealand, the arrival times vary throughout the country, so we are working with other local authorities in potentially affected areas to ensure that messaging is communicated. We're also working very closely with our national broadcasters, both in television and radio, to ensure that people get the most accurate information and to try and circumvent any panic or overreaction.
So you don't think, you're quite confident that people won't be evacuated and they won't need to go to higher ground?
They will need to move away and get to higher ground if they are at sea level. That's quite clear. I mean, if you have a beachfront property, it's advised you get away from the beach. That's a fundamental message that we're communicating. That's different to a widespread evacuation of a region.
Now, it was an 8.3 magnitude quake that set all this in process. Did you feel any of that in New Zealand?
No, not at all. We're totally reliant on the international community, of which New Zealand, of course, is a contributor in feeding information into that process. So it was the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre notification that we received, along with the media and everybody else at that time.
Okay, so Mr. Prowse, as far as you're concerned, things are going according to plan.
Yes. I mean, we have planned for these sorts of contingencies, and local authorities in particular have invested considerable amount of time and money to ensure that they have warning systems in place for the public, and particularly in high-risk areas of New Zealand.
Adrian Prowse of the Ministry of Civil Defence and Emergency Management in New Zealand, thank you very much for your time this morning. We know you're really busy. Thank you so much.
Okay, Geraldine, thank you.
And one of our regular guests, Sean Dorney, is not at his post in Brisbane, Australia, where he normally is when we're calling, but he's at the airport in Guam, or on his way to the airport in Guam. And to find out why the ABC's Australia Network Pacific correspondent is there, we say a very good morning to Sean Dorney.
Good morning, Geraldine. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you very much. And why are you in Guam?
I'm on my way to the Federated States of Micronesia, the Tuna Commission, the Central and Western Pacific Fisheries Commission, is having a compliance meeting, an annual compliance meeting over the next few days. And I've been wanting for quite some time to get to Pohnpei to do something on the Fisheries Commission, and I thought this was going to be a good opportunity to go there while there is a meeting on. I'm also going to be trying to do a bit of a story on the observers that are being trained up to be on board fishing boats to ensure that these boats that are fishing for tuna in the Pacific are actually obeying the rules.
Interesting stories. And another one that's come up since you've been in Guam is the Lieutenant Governor is being called up to serve in Afghanistan.
Yes, the Pacific Daily News had this story saying that Mike Cruz, the Lieutenant Governor, is scheduled to be deployed to Afghanistan next month. He's a colonel in the National Guard, and he's been called up to serve in Afghanistan. He's a doctor, and he'll be serving there as a surgeon. And he's also, according to the news report here, going to be running for the governorship itself when the next election comes up. But he doesn't think that his tour of duty in Afghanistan is going to do him any damage. And in a place like Guam, where there is such a commitment to America and also to the Army, I don't think it's going to do him much harm at all.
Exactly. Now, you've got some severe weather warnings there as well.
Yes, there was a bit of concern here yesterday about three separate weather systems that were developing. There was a bit of worry that one might develop into a typhoon and hit Guam. We had a little bit of rain last night, but the worst of those three weather systems seems now to be heading for the Philippines. So, yes, there was a bit of concern here, and in fact, we got a note at this hotel that they were coming down to remove all the furniture from the balconies in case there were very, very strong winds. But looking outside now, there's not a lot of evidence that there's been much of a storm.
Okay, Sean, we're going to make this a quick little chat today because you've got to get off to the airport, and we'll move along in the program today as well. Good luck with your trip, and we expect to hear some really good stories from you.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Australian Network's Pacific correspondent Sean Dorney speaking with us this morning from Guam en route to the Federated States of Micronesia. Now we're going to shoot on over to Papua New Guinea, where we say a very good morning to our Pacific correspondent there, Liam Fox. Howdy, Liam. How are you doing?
Good morning. Good, thanks.
Now then, you've had a prison break, and it's a bit of an intriguing story as well.
Yeah, that's right. It happened on Sunday afternoon at the same time as the Australian Prime Minister's 13 rugby league team was playing the PNG Kumuls. The police had their hands busy keeping the crowd's passions in check down there. There are a lot of people who missed out on tickets and were throwing rocks into the ground and things like that. And while this was going on, 54 prisoners managed to escape from the Bomana prison outside of Port Moresby. They used bolt cutters to capture a number of fences. And Corrective Services says one of the reasons is because only a skeleton staff turned up for work that day, so they were undermanned. Now, it turns out that among those escapees, 21 are convicted criminals. They want to serving time for offences such as rape, armed robbery, and murder. And the rest were remandees waiting for trial. And among those remandees were three men who were charged with murder over the murder of a prominent businessman, Sir George Constantino, who was killed during a botched carjacking in Moresby last year. So it's quite a big story here, and there'll no doubt be more developments.
Bolt cutters, that's not something they made in the workshop, I suppose, at the prison.
No, well, the Corrective Services Department's Deputy Commissioner, Henry Warwick, we spoke to him on Monday, he said he suspects it's an inside job, that some of the wardens actually helped the prisoners and possibly provided the bolt cutters.
And any more information on that? I mean, do we know why they would assist their prisoners to escape?
Well, Henry Warwick says, you know, the Wontok system here in Papua New Guinea, where you help out relatives and friends, that possibly that may have come into play, that wardens may have helped their Wontoks, their relatives, to get out. But investigations are ongoing, so there's no definitive answer to that one as of yet.
No. Police, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry?
Go ahead, yeah.
I was just saying, we spoke to the Metropolitan Superintendent of Police yesterday, Mr. Fred Yacastler, who said that the manhunt will really get underway today. They've been investigating for the last couple of days, and today's the day when they're going to deploy police around Port Moresby and into Central Province, surrounding Central Province, to start looking for these escapees.
That's what I was about to ask you. How many are still at large, and have they recovered any?
They recovered three soon after the prison break, so there's 51 still at large.
Okay. Now, just very quickly, there's been another death on the Kokoda Trail. Is that getting much headline there in Port Moresby?
No, it's not. It's only received brief attention, and that's because compared to other ones, possibly this one was a little less controversial than, say, the plane crash and two other Australian deaths while walking the track earlier this year. It appears the Townsville man, Mr. Paul Bradfield, died of a suspected heart attack at night in the village of Lafogie. So it wasn't while he was physically walking the track, but happened in the early hours of the morning. I've spoken to people who are out there. They say the afternoon before it happened, he was happily playing football with kids in the village in Lafogie, and then started suffering breathing difficulties later that night and then passed away soon after.
Liam Fox, we'll leave it there this morning. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll speak to you at the same time next week.
Pleasure. Thank you.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Geraldine Coutts. And three children have been killed in Samoa, and the death toll is expected to climb as a tsunami sweeps through the Pacific Ocean. The tsunami was generated by a magnitude 8.3 quake, which struck 200 kilometres southwest of American Samoa. And just there are warnings and watches, so I'd like just to finish off the program today to run through some of those. The 8.3 magnitude quake starting off a tsunami that's going around the region. And the tsunami warning is in effect for American Samoa, Samoa, Niue Island, Wallis and Futuna Islands, Tokelau, Cook Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Kermadec Islands, the Baker and Howland Islands, Jarvis Island, French Polynesia and the Palmyra Islands, and a tsunami watch issued for Vanuatu, Nauru, Marshall Islands, Solomon Islands, New Caledonia, Kosrae, Papua New Guinea, Hawaii, Ponape, Wake Islands, Pitcairn and the Midway Islands. And on that note, we say farewell to you this morning. I'm Geraldine Coutts. We'll be back at the same time with more tomorrow.
The Republican period from 1912 to 1949 is often regarded as a sort of embarrassing, rather dark, backwater period full of violence, and really is only important because it paves the way for Chairman Mao and the communists.
It was also the time when China closed the door on 2,000 years of imperial rule and experimented with modernity in every sphere of life. China before Mao. That's Rear Vision, this evening, 6:30 Suva time, here on Radio Australia.
This is Radio Australia.
Via satellite, shortwave and online.
Radio Australia.
Listen to Radio Australia on webstream at radioaustralia.net.au.
You're listening to Radio Australia.
Australia.
In English,
Australia.
Indonesian, Australia. Pidgin, Chinese, Vietnamese and Khmer, and online in French.
On Radio Australia.
Radio Australia.
Across Asia and the Pacific region.
You're listening to Radio Australia.